This is an ABC podcast.
The international hit TV series Adolescence has blown up, getting people talking about what is actually going on in the lives of their teenagers.
It's crazy what your brain tells you to do when you're a kid.
It's hit home, especially for parents of teenagers who wonder about their young people and the state of their mental health. Today, some work in the right direction. We take you to Gippsland in Victoria, where an educational program is giving teenagers the skill to look after their own mental health and help their peers too.
And people often say to me, you know, there's so many young people that are suffering at the moment. It was never like that. Well, maybe it was. You know, it was always a very hidden topic, so that stigma isn't quite as bad as it was.
There's a trend in the Northern Territory where people come, stay for a bit, and then they leave. It's not good for population growth, and the government has some controversial plans to reverse it. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, and it's coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. ₺1,200 kilometres northeast of Perth, the mining town of Newman produces billions of dollars worth of iron ore. It's also a service hub for some of Australia's most remote communities. Indigenous people from central Western Australia travel hundreds of kilometres to Newman for life-saving dialysis treatment. But when they arrive, many of them don't have a safe place to stay. Local health advocates say that needs to change. Alistair Bates has the story.
Blood pumping through a dialysis machine, Jigalong elder Peggy Peterson lets the hum of the health clinic in this remote WA town wash over her. She's exhausted after a restless night staying with 10 of her relatives.
We had the family members coming in, knocking on the door and banging on the door.
Hers is a story often heard by the staff at Newman's Punta Kurnu Aboriginal Medical Service, or PAMS. Dozens of Indigenous elders travel here to central WA from remote communities hundreds of kilometres away. They come to receive life-saving renal care, sometimes as frequently as 3 times a week. But many, like Miss Peterson, must rely on friends and family for accommodation. Health workers say it's exacerbating housing shortages and overcrowding, forcing some patients to sleep rough at the local football oval.
Just because they've got no house in Newman, if they don't dialyze, they die. So they opt to sleep on the street.
Robbie Chibawe, the CEO of PAMS, says others also face rare and harmful diseases.
Communicable diseases like impetigo, like scabies, like trachoma, these are preventable.
Mr. Chibawe is asking for $9 million from the state and federal governments to construct a short-stay hostel in Newman. Similar facilities exist elsewhere in WA, attached to dialysis units in Kalgoorlie and Port Hedland. Other hostels are in the works for Broome and Karratha. But Mr. Chibawe says nowhere are outcomes worse than for Indigenous people from the great sandy desert surrounding Newman, known as the Mardu.
Mardu, on average, they live between 40 and 45 years. Now, remember that someone who is on dialysis is already immunocompromised. The immunity is weak. So expecting such an elder to stay with family of 15, 20 people is just not ideal.
A short drive from the PAMS clinic, mining giant BHP pulls billions of dollars in iron ore out of the red earth. The Australian multinational owns 1,100 houses in Newman, 130 of which are boarded up and unoccupied. Rod Ballinger, general manager of BHP's Newman operations, acknowledges the company needs to hand more of the abandoned houses back to the community.
I'd recognise it hasn't been as fast as what we would have liked collectively as a community, but starting to see some real progress now, and that is exciting.
Last year, the company transferred 5 houses and $4 million to PAMS to get the renal hostel project rolling. But Mr. Chibawe says more capital funds are needed to make the facility a reality.
We have to put money where there's entrenched disadvantage. The last gap in that equation is that hostel.
For Ms. Peterson, the ability to receive treatment in Newman is crucial for her to remain connected to her home country and grandchildren.
In Jigalong, you go out cutting and be with the families and enjoy it in a community life. But here, it's different. It is important because we are Indigenous people of Australia, and you know, we should have right to ask for things what we need because of our health.
Peggy Peterson, an elder from the remote community of Jigalong, ending that story from Alistair Bates. And you can read more about this story on ABC News website. You're listening to Australia Wide and I'm Sinead Mangan. Thanks for your company today. We're going to head now to Gippsland in Victoria, where an educational programme is giving teenagers the skills they need to look after their own mental health and help their peers too. This story is from Daniel Cutchell, and a warning for listeners, it does discuss suicide and self-harm, so please take care.
Young Australians are facing a high mental health burden. The Australian Institute of Health and Welfare has identified anxiety and depression as the top three most common chronic conditions for people aged between 15 and 24. In Borborshire, there is Youth Live for Life, a program helping teenagers to look after their own mental health and that of their mates. It's here they learn why maintaining mental health is important, strategies to help, and who they can talk to if things get too much. As part of a youth leadership program called Crew for Life, students deliver health promotion activities in their schools and communities. The community-level approach starts with students building their leadership skills year on year. Adults learn alongside them, and between them, they build a community with the language and understanding to tackle mental ill health and hopefully reduce suicide and self-harm.
Basically, Live for Life is creating a movement, and it's a movement led by young people.
That's Bernard Galbally, CEO of Youth Live for Life. He says he became involved in the program after moving to a rural area and learning rates of mental health challenges are higher in the country than in city areas.
There are a lack of services and supports around mental health in rural and regional communities. The Royal Commission into Victoria's mental health system, the interim report showed that more than 63% of young people that were trying to access a mental health service couldn't access a service, and that was very different than for Metro.
Youth Live for Life began in 2010 in the Macedon Ranges as a response to a reported increase in youth disengagement, mental illness, self-harm and suicide. After an evaluation found it to be a success, it expanded to other communities, including Borbor, where it began in 2020.
The Borbor community has been incredible, but you have over 18 organisations that are part of the Live for Life Borbor School and Community Partnership Group. And since then, over the last 4 years, over 3,000 young people have been trained up in evidence-based mental health education.
He says young people often tell him why they've joined the program, from their own lived experience to watching family members go through struggles.
But sometimes it's just that they are just caring people and they just want to improve their community.
Eli Gawley is in Year 12 at Warragul Specialist School. He says what he's learned at Live for Life has literally saved lives.
One of my friends actually was very close to committing suicide, but I helped them out massively. And it was quite scary for me and my friend, but because I was there to help them out, they got out of it very luckily.
Now he and his friends feel better equipped to deal when situations like this occur.
Speaking about mental health is a big thing. Like me and a few of my other friends, we have been through this. We've gone down this dangerous curve, but thanks to the Live for Life and our people, we were able to get out of it. And Live for Life really helped us out a lot with that moment.
He believes Live for Life's training will stand him in good stead when he enters the professional workforce, giving him skills he can draw upon if he notices colleagues struggling with their mental health. Blake Stone, a Year 10 student at Trafalgar High School, is doing the program for the second year in a row. He says mental health problems are common among students all around Victoria.
Could be anything from stress. I know quite a few people where it's family matters and problems. Others just overloaded schoolwork sometimes.
The program has taught him how to talk to people in mental distress and which services to suggest to them for getting professional help.
When I learnt it, I could see how many people actually needed this help that I knew.
He's hoping to return as part of Crew for Life next year to continue working with youth in Borborshire. With the experience he's gained from the program, he hopes to become a therapist in a children's hospital.
I originally wanted to go be a pilot, and then I got to come with my friends to Live for Life, and my sights on career changed and slowly became more and more on helping people.
Suzanne Lampert is a mental health promotion officer at La Trobe Regional Health. She was instrumental in bringing Youth Live for Life to Gippsland. The program operates in the La Trobe, South Gippsland and Wellington Council areas, as well as Borborshire. And Suzanne knows much of its success is down to open conversations about mental health.
And people often say to me, you know, there's so many young people that are suffering at the moment. It was never like that. Well, maybe it was. You know, it was always a very hidden topic. So that stigma isn't quite as bad as it was.
She says Youth Live for Life helps normalise mental health, making it socially acceptable to talk about it and gives people strategies to get help. It's not just about schools, she adds. It's about connecting and upskilling the whole community to know what good mental health looks like, the difference between good days, bad days and a crisis, and what help is out there. Now, teenagers know where to go and the adults in their lives know what to do when someone is in crisis.
I can assure you the literacy has improved, yeah. We've certainly had a lot more of young people wanting to understand what is in our community in terms of help they can access. You know, information's power.
Danielle Cutchell reporting there from Gippsland. And if you or someone you know needs help, you can contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. That's 13 11 14. Or there is the Kids Helpline on 1800 551 800.
ABC Australia Wide.
How do the farmers feel about the price they're getting?
Absolutely stoked.
On ABC Radio.
More young people than ever will be casting their votes in next month's federal election. But not all of those Gen Zs and millennials are looking forward to it. As reporter Alice Angeloni found out when she chatted to some young voters on the mid-north coast of New South Wales.
Honestly, I feel unknowledgeable about it, so I feel kind of almost embarrassed sometimes when people ask.
Liam's 27 and a carpenter living on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. And right now, we're talking politics.
It's something that I have in the past put a lot of time and energy in, but if you don't keep up with it, like, I have no idea what's going on at this very day.
Liam's obviously not the only one in this dilemma. Data shows Australians, young and old, think news is difficult to understand, a higher proportion than in some other countries. I'm getting Liam's thoughts because of the federal election campaign. And Liam reckons a few years back, around the time of ScoMo, he tapped out.
The last election, I actually handed in a blank ballot, so I didn't put a vote in because I didn't feel that I wanted one party more than the other. I didn't feel like either of them were something that I would vote for.
Liam says he also didn't feel like he could make an informed decision.
I don't have enough knowledge about these guys to be the one to decide if they can make the changes that I need or be the leader that I want. Like, yeah, I didn't put enough time and effort into that, so I don't feel like I needed to have a say.
Crystal is studying in Coffs Harbour.
My vote would be null and void because I would not choose a selected party due to lack of education. I've decided to stay unenrolled and save my time on those days and my energy.
It's compulsory to enrol to vote in Australia if you're over 18.
It still feels like to make a conscious decision, which is aligned with my own beliefs and values, I need to educate myself in all of the party's beliefs and values. And that takes a long time when a lot of the political realm seems to enjoy creating biases against one another that are grounded in fear.
Crystal also feels like politics, especially during election campaigns, just doesn't align with her values or the values of some other young people.
Super off-putting and really outdated. Completely fine for, I don't want to say older demographics, but it's true that society's changing in the way that they make decisions.
Angel is 26 and says she'll be voting for the first time in this election.
Reason being is the cost of living crisis.
Angel says she gets most of her news from social media.
If I want to look anything up to inform myself further, I'm sure things will pop up in my news feed and or I will be looking at the parties and their social media pages.
So how widespread is this avoiding of the news? Dr. Sora Park is a researcher at the University of Canberra.
For young people under the age of 35, they are four times more likely to say they avoid news because it's hard to follow or understand.
That's why 16% of young people say they avoid the news.
Another big reason for young people is that they feel there is nothing they can do with that information.
If people are avoiding news, how does that translate to voting habits?
While we don't know the exact stats about what happens next, it's probably that young people will be less engaged, they will make uninformed decisions, be swayed by misinformation and so forth.
But Dr. Park acknowledges that not consuming news and political news doesn't necessarily mean young people are not engaged. Back to my chat with Liam. He agrees politics just isn't hitting the mark for him.
I feel like the ads that each party puts out are just so negative. Just trying to attack and put down the opposition rather than like promoting things that they actually want to implement and change.
No judgment space. But it is for national radio. What do you reckon your approach is going to be this time?
Well, after this, probably be doing a bit of research. I don't even know who's actually... Oh, no, I do know the leaders. That's not fair.
Who's the Prime Minister?
No.
Okay.
Alessandra Loney reporting there from Coffs Harbour. She caught him there. The population in the Northern Territory is known for being transient. People come, stay for a while, and then they leave. The Territory's population has been growing by an average of less than 2,000 people a year over the last decade. That's the slowest growth rate in this country. But the government has an ambitious goal. They want to double that growth rate, and they want people to come to the Northern Territory and stay in the Northern Territory. Joseph Hathaway-Wilson has been looking into this story. Now, Joseph, why does the government want to grow the population?
Well, there's a couple of reasons for this renewed push to boost the Northern Territory's population. In short, it's because they want to get greater GST revenue, and they also want to increase the demand for small business services as well as public sector services, and thus increase the supply. Now, this isn't necessarily a new thing. Governments of both sides have been wanting to boost the population for decades on end, and this 4,000 number, 4,000 people a year, that's something that's only been achieved a handful of times since the 1980s. I guess it's particularly pertinent now because the government in the Northern Territory is in crippling debt. I think it's nearly $12 billion of debt at the moment. And it's so bad that the government has recently scrapped its debt ceiling, which would have capped our debt at $15 billion. So it's expecting to go over that. Mm-hmm. On the back of that, the Treasurer, Bill Yan, has announced this new initiative to boost the Northern Territory's population by net 4,000 people per year. And the idea is he wants to stimulate the economy and claw back some of that debt that we're currently in. Here's what he had to say about it to us.
That helps grow our population, grows our GST base, but also grows business right across the territory. And that's part of the action and certainty and security we're looking for the future. We need these people to come and move to the territory and live here. And of course, then that grows our smaller businesses.
That's Treasurer, Northern Territory Treasurer Bill Yan speaking there. Now, how do the government propose to do this? How do they grow the population by 4,000 people?
Well, there's a couple of different measures that they're resorting to here. One of the most recent ones, which they announced, was the signing of the Dharma 3. That's the Designated Area Migration Agreement 3. It's a new and improved agreement between the Territory Government and the Federal Government, which will essentially allow up to 1,500 skilled migrants to come and settle in the Northern Territory from overseas. That's 1,500 every year. Another initiative that Bill Yan was speaking about was scrapping, or not necessarily scrapping, but reducing the amount of fly-in, fly-out work in the Northern Territory. Now, as you mentioned in the introduction, we've got an incredibly transient population up here, and a large part of that is because of these large-scale infrastructure projects. So that's things like, you know, gas plants and mines and huge construction works. I think anyone who's lived in the NT in recent decades will recall the INPEX gas plant mm-hmm. and the huge influx of population that that brought from overseas, as well as the refurbishment of the waterfront precinct back in the mid-2000s. A third measure that the Treasurer wants to resort to is simply building more homes and encouraging people to buy them. Now, that's based on this sort of generally agreed upon logic that if you get more people buying homes and laying down roots in the territory, then they're going to stay here. But the problem is people aren't doing that yet. They're coming and they're staying for about 2 years, working on whatever project it was that brought them here, and then they're leaving.
So, Joseph, going back to that emigration piece, does the Territory already have lots of immigrants coming from overseas, and how did that work in terms of stimulating population growth?
Well, this is the interesting thing, is that we do. We get tons of overseas migrants every year in the Northern Territory. We more than pull our weight. In fact, over the past 30 years, if you look at every financial year for the past three decades, only once, and it was in the middle of the COVID-19 pandemic, only once has our net overseas migration actually gone backwards. In every other of those 29 years, we've picked up, we've taken on thousands of people, sometimes up to 4,000, usually around the 2,000, 3,000 mark. Now, that's interesting because we're taking on all of these international migrants, and by the sounds of it, the government's happy with that. They want to keep taking them on. but it's not boosting our population the way that it should. That's because while we're taking on people from overseas, we're losing just as many people interstate. Now, the graphs that we have and the data that we have, which shows that same story, tracking the net migration interstate into the territory, is almost a mirror image of the overseas migration graphs, but in the opposite direction. We're losing people every year. On very few occasions have we actually taken on more people from interstate than we've lost. In fact, the last time we did was 20 years ago during that refurbishment of the waterfront precinct. Since then, we've lost people to other states and territories every year. And it's essentially cancelling out all the gains that we make from international migration.
Now, Joseph, you've spoken to demographer Associate Professor Andrew Taylor about this. What did he have to say?
Yeah, so he had a couple of things to say. And he did think that the target that we're setting, this 4,000 people per year, is quite ambitious, given we take on quite a lot of it seems quite reliant on international migration, and we're already doing quite well in that department. By the sounds of it, he didn't think that enough was being done to keep these people here in the long term. Now, he agreed with the Treasurer's plan to get people to build more homes and buy more homes and lay down roots, which will encourage them to stay for around that five-year period, from which point people usually end up staying for the rest of their lives. But he pointed to something interesting which doesn't get tossed around in the economic sphere so much, which is soft factors. The idea that people are encouraged to or incentivized to stay in a place for a long time due to sort of fluffier things, not so much quantitative measures, but things like feeling connected to the communities that they're a part of. Here's what he had to say on that.
There are a range of other things that government might look at, and indeed some of our research suggests is very important. And those are what some demographers call the soft factors, providing good education, encouraging social and volunteering participation, essentially encouraging the formation of social networks and getting people engaged with the community and embedded in the community through social activities and cultural activities and enjoying each other's company.
Associate Professor Andrew Taylor, who's a demographer, there speaking to our reporter, Joseph Hathaway-Wilson. Now, Joseph, I mean, the complete opposite to that is the fly-in, fly-out workforce, because they can't get connected to a community because they are flying in and out. What role does FIFO play in all of this?
Yeah, so this is a point of contention between the two different sides of this debate that we've heard from so far. Now, Treasurer Bill Yan wants to reduce the number of FIFO workers in the territory. He says, well, if we can encourage those people to actually buy homes here, then we're essentially solving our, you know, population problem, or going a long way towards solving the population problem, because all the masses of people that we take on every year, usually internationally, will end up staying, they'll have children, etc., and the population grows from there. What Andrew Taylor said in that regard was that, well, it might work, and he didn't shut it down, but he said, we are so contingent on FIFO workers. In fact, we're of all the states and territories in Australia, the Northern Territory has the second highest number of non-residential workforce after the ACT. So he said, trying to scrap FIFO work, which it should be noted isn't the CLP's initiative. That's something, you know, Michael Gunner wanted to bring down FIFO work as well. It's been something governments have been talking about for a long time. He said it's a nice idea and it could work, but there's a lot more to it than people may think.
Fascinating, isn't it? Joseph Hathaway-Wilson in Darwin. Thanks very much for chatting to me about it and on Australia Wide.
Thank you for having me.
Energy is a key issue in this upcoming federal election, and all over the country, people are battling with high power bills. And some communities are facing big transitions away from traditional power sources. There is plenty of diverse viewpoints on what should be done about these issues. So Jeremy Jones and Freya Jetson hit the streets of Rockhampton in Queensland to hear some of those views.
I'm not against green energy. I just think it's got to be done realistically. They're putting in farmland, which is absolutely ridiculous. Yeah, heaps of better alternatives at the moment. Nuclear is almost there with the modular reactors. People have got this crazy thing about how dangerous it is. If you look at per petawatt hour, nuclear energy is safest by far.
I think it's probably a bit late to start nuclear now, but I guess keeping going with coal until they have a good renewable option to kind of keep it all flowing, sort of thing. That's what I seem to have gathered.
I believe that if you don't have $1,000 in your bank account,
and you just live from day to day and you eat your money, and if you don't have the money there the next day you don't eat, so how are you going to pay electricity? But if the people are the rich and they've got $10,000, they should be on a different bracket and they should be charged more, like a standard rate what they get charged. But the people that are lower, that don't, they can't even eat and they can't even put the heater on, but they choose the heater before food, so they obviously choose food. They should be have a lower rate, so then they could have a little bit of heat and a little bit of food.
I think they should be making it a lot more accessible for people that are on a pension and a small payment, to reduce those power payments compared to miners, executives that are having the same power but have got far bigger financial investments in their bank. And I think that should be reduced for the lower income population.
Do you have a preference over nuclear energy, renewables or coal?
I prefer solar, because nuclear, I don't even like that word. It's too toxic.
It's not just the electricity, it's the rent, it's the housing, it's the food, it's everything.
So I would assume the power prices should be reasonable for everyone. In summers, the power consumption goes high, winter's power consumption goes high, and the subsidy will remain to that level. But if the prices overall it's low, it will benefit the middle class and the lower middle class people as well. Any kind of subsidy is good, but overall the prices has to go down. Subsidy is not the solution.
I dread when the power bill kind of comes.
I don't think she's the only one. Some voices there from the streets of Queensland talking about the high power bills everybody's been slugged with at the moment. Energy has been coming up again and again in submissions to Your Say on the ABC. And if you want to get involved, it's a way for you to have your concerns and questions heard before the election, like those people just have. For more, you can go to the ABC News website and search Your Say. Huge amounts of water continue to move through central Australia in the aftermath of Cyclone Alfred, and it's a sight to behold. This is the beauty of all of this. Flooding is occurring in the northeast of South Australia at Cooper Creek and along the Diamantina River system, and it's heading for Lake Eyre. For pilot Trevor Wright, who's been operating scenic flights over Lake Eyre for years, the expanse of this flood is one for the record books and for the memory banks.
I call it an inland tsunami. It's just huge and it's just flowing out into the countryside. It's just amazing. Like when I saw it near Innamincka Station, you know, I just went, what the hell? You can see it kind of spraying on the trunks of the trees as it comes through the Coopers around that bend there near Innamincka. The flow rate's amazing. Speed blew me away. It was just moving forward. You could physically see it, whereas normally when you have these floods coming down, what I've seen in the past, it's incredibly slow moving, but this one, I've never seen anything like it before. Also around Innamincka, just how deep it's got, also the damage it's caused, especially with Innamincka Station. And then north, I noticed in Appomattox, I think the generator went under and they had to replace that with a helicopter coming, slinging it out there and dropping it into them.
Yeah, because, I mean, obviously we've had floodwaters come through that area before and you would have been up and seen it. This is moving at a faster clip than what you even expected.
The flow rate is just incredible. You can see it, and I've never seen it to that level before, going through the floods I've seen in the past. But looking there now, and when you go out towards Napamary and keep going up, just the pure volume and surface area of it, it's going to keep coming for quite a while. And then going through the Diamantina and down through Birdsville, the amount of water coming down that way is huge, I think. It's a really large flood, in my opinion, from what I visually saw from the air. It's now past Birdsville and it's still rising, or it was yesterday, and towards Lake Eyre. From the point of view of flying around and having worked with a lot of these floods before, this one leaves the other ones that I've seen for dead. And the other thing that I find interesting is you're going to have the whole three systems, the Georgina, the Diamantina, and the Coopers all coming together, going into the lake, going down. So there's going to be a huge amount of water going into it.
No doubt people will be hearing, well, water coming into those areas, it's always a spectacular sight. Are you expecting at some point there will be a bit of a tourism boost with people wanting to come and see those waters?
Yeah, look, I'm sure it'll increase inland tourism, but you know, you have to weigh that against the carnage that's been caused by all the stations and people living in the towns out there, because you do feel a great amount of remorse in what they've had to go through and what they've lost. And I think it needs to be balanced. Yes, you know, it will increase tourism, but there's been a real hit on the other side of it, that's for sure.
It's very true. Local pilot Trevor Wright from Wright's Air speaking with Selena Green. And that's Australia-wide for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. It's been lovely to have your company today. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.